Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Nutrition is a huge area of both research and consumer interest. What's the right thing to eat? Should calories in equal calories out? What about fat, salt, sugar? My guest today, author Gary Taubes, has spent the last 15 years looking at the science of nutrition, and more recently at sugar in particular. Deemed with the phrase generally recognized as safe by the FDA, sugar has a long and complicated history intertwined with human agriculture, industrialization, and consumption. Taubes wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story in 2011, which asked, "Is sugar toxic?" Many researchers have considered sugar an intoxicant, akin to a pleasure-inducing drug, because it hits the same brain nucleus as cocaine, nicotine, heroin, or alcohol. The food industry has worked hard to downplay any ill health effects of sugar, in spite of the fact we are in the midst of epidemics of diabetes and obesity, as well as the less well-known fatty liver disease, which as many as 10% of all children suffer from. It comes from the liver's inability to handle the large amounts of fructose we ingest. Taubes' latest book, The Case Against Sugar, is written as a legal case leading inexorably to the conclusion that we eat too much sugar and that it's bad for our health. It's just out in paperback, and it's a fascinating read. Science writer Gary Taubes, author of The Case Against Sugar, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Gary Taubes, welcome to Medical Monday. The name of the book is The Case Against Sugar, so let's start. What I like about the book is it really is not just, well, I mean, maybe it is, like you wrote it as a legal case, you set it up that way, but what's great about it is it's comprehensive in its breadth. And what I loved about it, sort of as an amateur historian, was the history. You teach us about the history of sugar as a commodity in the old world and in the new world and all the way to big sugar. So let's start basic and just tell us about the composition of sugar, because you are a science writer with a background, I think, as a physicist or trained in your undergraduate degree. When we talk about sugar, we have to be careful about what we mean. So if you don't mind sharing with us the different kinds of sugar, let's start with that.
Yeah, no, that's it's funny because one of the reasons, so I approach this historically because I think you have to understand how we got into this somewhat dire situation we're in today. But one of the problems all along with sugar and its interaction with health is that some of the leading authorities in the field, and this is up until very recently, might even argue still, don't actually know what they're talking about when they use the word sugar. And I commit a cardinal sin in my book, which if I slow it down right at the end of the introductory chapter to say, can we just talk about terms here for a second? When we're talking about sugar is a type of carbohydrate, and you know, when you eat starches or bread or grains, you digest those into your body, absorbs them as glucose, a simple carb, and it goes into your bloodstream, and you metabolize that glucose in effectively every cell in your body. And blood sugar, when your doctor says he's going to check your blood sugar, that's glucose. And sugars, the sweet stuff that we consume, so primarily either sucrose, what you get from cane or beets, or high fructose corn syrup. And these are combinations of glucose, almost 50-50 combinations of glucose and a simple carb called fructose. And fructose is the sweetest of the carbohydrates, and that's why we taste these carbs as sweet. And fructose is found naturally in fruit and green vegetables to a lesser extent. So that's why it's referred to often as fruit sugar. And sucrose can also be found in fruit. So our bodies basically are designed to deal with the sugar content of fruit, and we would have gotten that fruit, you know, a couple months a year when it was in season, and that's the only time we'd ever see. So we'd see a little bit of sugar, a little bit of fructose. The fructose, I should have said, is metabolized almost exclusively in our liver. So our liver specifically is designed to metabolize a little bit of fructose a couple months a year, small doses, and spread out over a few hours, because you would eat it in fruit, and you'd have to digest the fruit and separate the carbs, the digestible carbs from the fiber in the fruit. And then what we did over the past couple hundred years is with the Industrial Revolution and the creation of the beet sugar industry and then the corn refiners and their high fructose corn syrup, is we basically made sugar inexpensive, easy to consume. We packaged it in products, the candies, chocolates, ice creams, fruit juices, breakfast cereals, soft drinks, sports drinks, such that our livers are basically asked to do this job of metabolizing massive amounts of fructose from the moment we get up to the moment we go to sleep. And the argument, the biochemical, sort of physiological argument I make in this book that others have made before me, is that our livers are not designed to do that job. They're
right,
not designed to deal with that kind of fructose load. And so they do it poorly, like any machine that's being asked to do a job it wasn't designed to do. And the side effects of them doing it poorly are non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is epidemic today in America, are obesity and type 2 diabetes and all the chronic diseases that associate with them.
Right, so diabetes and obesity, I think there's pretty good awareness of that, but the fatty liver, as it's colloquially known, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, meaning it's not from drinking too much alcohol, but in fact from eating too much carbohydrate. And give us a sense of how big a problem that is.
Well, this is what today, there are estimates that 10% of all kids now have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So this, as you mentioned, this was the disease that 20 years ago, if you were diagnosed with fatty liver and you told your doctor you didn't drink alcohol, your doctor assumed you were lying to him. Then it starts showing up in kids, and the kids clearly aren't drinking alcohol. Now it's like 1 in 10, and in some populations even higher. But what's key to this is that, again, when the liver has to metabolize fructose in high doses, it turns it into fat. So sugar should be the prime suspect for fatty liver disease. But there's also a significant amount of evidence that this condition called insulin resistance, which when you resist your body, your cells are resistant to the action of insulin, and insulin resistance is the sort of fundamental defect in the common form of diabetes known as type 2 diabetes. There's significant evidence that insulin resistance starts with fat accumulation in the liver, which is, again, a sort of causal pathway that I and others have hypothesized to argue that sugar is the cause. If sugar is the cause of insulin resistance, which it should be the prime suspect, then it's the cause of type 2 diabetes, then it's the cause of obesity, then it's at least the exacerbator of all these chronic diseases that associate with obesity and diabetes, which include not just heart disease and strokes and hypertension, but cancer and Alzheimer's.
So I want to ask you about Elliot Joslin, who you write about. The Joslin Diabetes Center is named after him in Boston. And you taught me, again, about the history of Elliot Joslin and what he accomplished by literally going through, was it every chart of a patient who'd been hospitalized at Massachusetts General Hospital in the early 1800s or the first half century? And just how uncommon was diabetes in the 1800s?
This is so, to put that question in context, let me tell you how common diabetes is today. So today, 1 in 11 Americans are estimated to have diabetes, both type 2 and type 1, the acute form that usually shows up in childhood. In some populations around the world, Native American populations, First Nations people in Canada, 1 in 2 adults are diabetic. They're Middle Eastern populations, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 are diabetic. I saw a study recently, 1 in 4 Pakistanis are diabetic. So this is sort of a chronic disease plague, the likes of which the world has never seen. And it's diabetes is a pretty clear diagnosis, although the diagnostic criteria have changed over the years. This was a disease that was first recognized 2,000 years ago by Hindu physicians. It was especially, the acute form that usually is seen in children is a very distinctive diagnosis. It's not easy to miss if you have any medical training at all. And yet, you go back to these medical records from the early to mid-19th century, for instance, Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, which has their records from 1824 onward, and there are year after year after year in which they saw not a single case of diabetes. And by the end of the 19th century, when observers like Elliot Joslin then at Harvard or Osler at Johns Hopkins were quantifying the diabetes cases they were seeing, they were talking about numbers in hospitals, hospital inpatient records of maybe 1 in 300 or 1 in 1,000 patients had diabetes, compared to, for instance, in the Veteran Administration hospitals today, 1 in 4 vets have diabetes.
Right, so you show that like a doctor could go through his or her, but mostly his in those days, career and never see a diabetic.
Yeah, exactly. And there were comments to that effect in the British doctors talking about diabetes in the late 19th, early 20th century, saying the only way you could ever see, you would only see a diabetic if you worked in a big urban hospital, you know, the incredibly busy hospital environment. There was a famous paper written on diabetes back in the late 18th century in which it's famous because the physician who wrote it was talking about 2 cases of diabetes that he had seen in his lifetime.
Two. It's
two.
Incredible.
20 years apart.
Yeah. One of the things that I learned, too, I learned so many things in your book, is that sugar, when it became an inexpensive commodity due to industrialization and our ability to process it into mass quantities, was that it became an additive in nearly every packaged food we can think of. And you also pointed out that sugar is one of the only, sugar and salt, I think they're not elements, they're pure
chemicals.
They're the only pure chemicals
that we consume.
But the thing about sugar that's so insidious, well, it's kind of like salt, because salt's kind of in everything too, in a package or a can, pretty much, unless it says, you know, no sodium or whatever. But sugar's in everything. Things we don't think of as sweet or candied or sweetened all have sugar because of these properties for baking or for one thing. I didn't really know this. I mean, I'm not much of a cook or baker, but that the sugar, I mean, it's a preservative, so it prevents food from spoiling. Is that, and then it helps, of course, with browning and caramelization and all those things.
Yeah, no, it's an incredibly useful ingredient. It's one of the problems when people entertained the idea that maybe they should label sugar as a food additive to not be generally recognized as safe. But now you've got a product that is it's incredibly useful, and for reasons, many reasons other than its sweetness. So when the FDA contemplated whether or not they should continue labeling sugar generally recognized safe in the 1970s, the authorities who were on this committee that was tasked to do it pointed out that it was opening a Pandora's box to say you can't use sugar. And so sugar was in effect too big to fail. It was already everywhere. And as such, you know, it was just easier to go with the consensus of the nutrition research community anyway, who were all blaming everything on fat and salt and saying sugar was benign. So they did that despite significant research, clinical trials suggesting that sugar was, all the problems that we've been discussing.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Gary Taubes. He's the author of The Case Against Sugar, which is just out in paperback, and is really a brilliant argument, including all of the history about big sugar, massive sugar industry in the United States. And Gary, what led you to, you did obviously tons of research. You'd written a previous book called Why We Get Fat. And so you decided to kind of frame this book as a legal argument. And I guess the first question with that is, why do you think there is such a lack of research into sugar as a so-called intoxicant or drug of abuse, as it were, because it hits the same pleasure centers as, say, cocaine?
Yeah, one of the problems I describe in the book is beginning in the 1960s, sort of in the post-war era in the U.S., nutrition obesity research communities followed some scientific canards, we can call them. A nutritionist at the University of Minnesota, who happened to get funding, perhaps coincidentally, from the sugar industry, came up with this idea that saturated fat and dietary fat causes heart disease. Researchers started doing studies to test that hypothesis in the 1960s. Those studies got bigger and more expensive in the 1970s. The U.S. Congress stepped in and decided it was so likely that fat caused heart disease that they were going to put out, this was a Senate committee run by Senator George McGovern, was going to put out a report, Dietary Goals for Americans, that was going to suggest all Americans eat less fat and we should eat less salt, which was another hypothesis that was cooking. And then by the 1980s, a whole series of government reports proclaimed that dietary fat was the primary killer in the American diet. It was the saturated fat content of the diet that was killing us and the salt content of the diet. And while there had been a competing hypothesis that sugar was the problem, that was mostly a British hypothesis, and the funding was in America, the sort of politically powerful researchers were in the U.S., and they just won out. And the sugar industry also stepped in to sort of back the anti-fat people, which they did, and they paid them to write studies, particularly this fellow named Fred Stair, who ran the nutrition department at Harvard. And they threw the Harvard name around liberally. And, you know, as a result, by the 1980s, it was considered quackery to insinuate that there might be something wrong about sugar other than it being empty calories or, you know, something we should consume immoderately. And so from the 1980s onward, the very little, you know, the researchers knew that to study sugar, its addictive nature, whether it caused hyperactivity, which was a hypothesis back then, or whether it caused heart disease, which is what these British researchers were arguing, or diabetes, was just something you didn't do. Nutritionists didn't do it. The government didn't fund that research. And we ended up having people sort of back into this research for other reasons. So, for instance, when we were talking about, you know, insulin resistance being the cause of type 2 diabetes, and there was a very influential group of researchers at Stanford who were studying the role of insulin resistance in diabetes and in heart disease and in obesity, and they needed an animal model of insulin resistance. And lo and behold, you could create insulin resistance in animals very easily by feeding them sugar. There were other researchers, there was this idea that maybe sugar was a healthy food for diabetics because it didn't elevate blood sugar because of the fructose component of sugar was being metabolized in the liver. And so you didn't need insulin to metabolize it, so maybe that was a good thing for diabetics. So other people started studying sugar because they thought it was a good thing, and then learning that, wait, and now clearly that's not what it is, or it appears clearly not be the case. So we started getting this research literature building up despite the fact that to actually study sugar with the hypothesis that it's addictive, or the hypothesis that we shouldn't be feeding it to our children from age 6 months onward, was something that nutritionists just didn't do.
There's this researcher that you turn us on to, is it John Yudkin?
Yudkin, yeah.
Who's a British researcher who does a lot of this work, but seems like just kind of toils in obscurity. What are some of the scientific advancements that he made?
Well, and Yudkin didn't toil in obscurity, but he eventually was tarred as a quack for his work. So Yudkin was the most prominent European nutritionist. And in fact, Yudkin, as a graduate student, had done some work which led to French biologists getting the Nobel Prize, and that French biologist credited Yudkin in his Nobel Prize lecture. Yudkin was responsible for founding the first dedicated department of nutrition in London, and was exceedingly well-respected, but he came up with this hypothesis that sugar, in effect, caused all these, you know, heart disease, diabetes, obesity through. In effect, he identified this insulin-resistant syndrome that today we call metabolic syndrome. He was arguably the very first to identify it and to say, I can cause all the various manifestations of this syndrome in animals by feeding them sugar. And he did that in the 1960s. But he was arguing that sugar was the cause of heart disease, not saturated fat. And by doing so, he was directly challenging this dietary fat hypothesis that was being promoted by the University of Minnesota nutritionist named Hansel Keys. And Keyes was just no-holds-barred fighter for his theory. I mean, the way he was described to me when I started this research 15 years ago was the kind of person about which people say he didn't suffer fools gladly. But by that, they mean that he would viciously attack anyone who disagreed with this hypothesis. And Keyes was the most powerful nutritionist in the U.S., and he managed to convince his community. Keyes and his fellows at the University of Minnesota managed to convince the research community that Yudkin was, in effect, a quack. And again, these folks had support from the sugar industry that was also funding people like Fred Stare at Harvard to indirectly make this argument that Yudkin was a quack. So by the late 1970s, researchers would say to me to try and study sugar was to be tarred as being, quote, just like Yudkin, unquote. And that's what I meant when I said it was just not something you could do and have a viable career.
So how does big sugar manifest itself now? I mean, it's not just sugar manufacturers, but it's really the food industry itself, right?
It's the beverage industry and the sugar industry, but it's interesting because they're not necessarily united. Like even back in the 1960s when the artificial sweeteners came on the scene in a big way in the 1950s, and the beverage industry, the Coca-Colas and PepsiCos of the world, were more than happy to use artificial sweeteners in their products because, A, artificial sweeteners are cheaper. And if people would buy them because they thought they were healthier, that was terrific. And so the sugar industry in the 1960s took it on themselves to fund the research to tar artificial sweeteners with the stench of being carcinogens. They got cyclamates banned. They almost got saccharin banned. This was all the work of the sugar industry because they were losing market share to the artificial sweeteners, and the beverage industry didn't care. Today, the problem is we're going after sugary beverages. So cities like Oakland, where I live, or Berkeley, or San Francisco, Philadelphia, other cities are enacting taxes on sugary beverages. So that kind of unites the beverage industry with the sugar industry. And they will spend a lot of money, as they have, fighting these taxes in the communities. It's sort of like, from their perspective, they're putting out fires everywhere to make sure that they don't grow. Easy, painful metaphor to use in California
these days.
They've always been an incredibly powerful lobby. But that said, I think the industry sees the writing on the wall. I think that's pretty clear. Sugar consumption in the U.S. actually peaked in 1999, a year after the real awareness started to spread that we had an obesity epidemic in the works. And it's been coming steadily downward. Sugary beverage consumption has been decreasing since 1999. And I think the industry clearly sees where this is going, but they're going to try and delay it as long as possible while they diversify into other products and, you know, try to make their shareholders like Warren Buffett happy.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Gary Taubes. He's author of The Case Against Sugar, which is just out in paperback. Gary, we were talking about the writing on the wall for the sugar industry, that peak sugar occurred in the United States in 1999. What are ways in which food and beverage companies, I mean, I know with the beverage companies, it's the diversifying into water. I mean, really. What about food companies? They're just going with, I mean, because there's so many dietary niches now, but if you think about gluten-free or sugar-free, or what are some of the other product lines you're seeing?
Well, again, it's interesting. One of the things that fascinates me is how quickly gluten-free products appeared. I mean, my local Safeway supermarket, there's an entire wall of gluten-free products where, you know, it's easier to market products as gluten-free than it is to market them as sugar-free. And the problem, like I said, the sugar industry successfully convinced people that artificial sweeteners shouldn't be consumed either. So, you know, what's left is effectively to kind of slowly ratchet down the sugar content of the foods we consume. And again, I think, and I live in a rarefied environment in Berkeley and Oakland, you know, Northern California. It's hard to judge if what I'm seeing here is what you would see in Tulsa or somebody would see in anywhere else in the country. But there's definitely, here at least, a spread of lower sugar products that are sweetened with honey or maple syrup, sort of paleo-type products, as they're often, you know, branded to appeal to those folks who are trying to avoid both refined sugar and refined grains. And again, I think it seems to be spreading. It also goes along with a counter movement, which is the vegetarian, the vegan movement, which implicitly blames red meat for all the same health problems that my research tells me has been caused by sugar and white flour primarily.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit and just ask you, there seems to be a common thread throughout your journalistic or your book writing career in terms of choosing topics that are controversial. On the one hand, that makes for good stories, good characters, but I wonder if you've reflected on what draws you to those types of things. And I mean, because you also wrote, I think, a ways back, was it your first book on the cold fusion story?
My second book. On cold fusion. So I see it in a different theme, because my first book, Nobel Dreams, I was embedded with a team of physicists at a physics laboratory outside of Geneva, and I spent 10 months with them watching them, in effect, discover non-existent fundamental particles and then learn how they had screwed up and how they should deal with the public relations backlash of making such a monumental mistake. And then my second book was about cold fusion, which was another scientific fiasco. And I became obsessed with this issue of how hard it is to do science right and how easy it is to get the wrong answer. So in issues of controversial science, there's two sides, and one of them is getting the right answer and one of them is getting the wrong answer. And it's usually pretty much that simple. So the question is, who's right? How do you do it? And I find those situations absolutely riveting. I mean, to me, that's where my heart lies. If I had my choice, my next book would be on exactly this subject, and I'd get out of nutrition entirely. I don't have my choice on that. But my career in the early 90s, some of my friends in the physics community said to me quite bluntly, if you're fascinated with bad science and controversial science, you should look at the stuff in public health because it's terrible. And everything I had learned in my first two books about how meticulous and rigorous and critical and skeptical you have to be to get the right, to even have a reasonable shot of getting the right answer in science, was considered a luxury in public health because it was too hard to do. And nutrition, I stumbled into the nutrition field in the late 90s. It just turned out to be the area in which the studies are exceedingly hard to do right. You're dealing with chronic diseases that manifest over years and decades. You're dealing with subjects, human beings who have minds of their own, who you can't just, you know, put in a cage and force feed like you can mice and rats. So the science is exceedingly, you know, almost impossibly challenging, and the nutrition obesity research communities responded to this challenge not by keeping their standards high and valiantly trying to overcome these challenges. They merely lowered their standards and said, in effect, we'll believe anything if it fits our preconceptions. And the truth is, I joke that all of my books are on the same subject. They're all about bad science. They're just in, you know, the first two are in physics and nuclear physics, and the last three have been in nutrition, and they sell a heck of a lot better when they're in nutrition than...
Everyone wants to know how it applies to me.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, the name of the book is The Case Against Sugar. It's a great read if you like history, if you like law, if you like science, if you like investigative journalism. It's really outstanding, and it is just out in paperback, and it's by my guest today, Gary Tobbs. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our interviews, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.